This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 26th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Today we'll kick off in Stockholm at the Swedish Association of Architects annual gala, finding about how the city is bracing itself as its population rapidly increases.
Equality has a lot to do with perception, with feeling excluded or inferior. It's important that people have the perception that they are connected. You don't have these isolated housing areas for low-income people.
Then we're off to Austria, 25 years after the pioneering creation of the Danube Island in its capital, Vienna.
In city planning, if a mistake is big enough, then later on it's called city development. And this has also been true here.
And then we'll be donning our red bracelets to find out what happens when Kabbalah meets the world of architecture.
The idea of repair, sustainability, the obligation of helping people and is something that is also equivalent in architecture. Even just something as basic as restoration.
All that, plus we'll hear from architect Charles Fu on the recent developments in the sector in Asia and a whole lot more. Here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Stockholm is one of Europe's most rapidly growing cities, with the equivalent of two busloads of people arriving every week. By 2030, the region will have doubled its size to about 4 million inhabitants. All of those people will need somewhere to live, and if the Swedish Association of Architects has its way, that somewhere will be a beautiful building designed by a professional architect. To that end, the association has transformed its annual party, formerly a small industry event, into a full-blown gala aimed at celebrating architecture and influencing politicians. Monocle's Elna Nykänen Andersson visited the gala and met with some of the keynote speakers to discuss Sweden's architectural climate. She kicks off with Tobias Olsson, Director of Architectural Policy at the Swedish Association of Architects.
Well, it's a whole day of architecture and lectures about architecture, and in the evening it's more of a dinner gala where we give out all our awards for the best architecture in Sweden this year. It's a celebration of architecture, so to speak. It's an opportunity for architects in Sweden to meet each other and also to be inspired. We always try to invite the most interesting international architects on a theme. And this year's theme was the climate of architecture, both the climate change and the sustainability, but also the political climate of architecture in Sweden today. We also want to make architecture more fun, and we want to make architecture more relevant for everybody. And instead of having a day of architecture that was mostly about lectures per se and then just giving out the awards, we wanted to do something more, to invite a lot of politicians, of real estate owners, of building contractors, to widen the people that came to the gala. So it's not only architects, but it's architecture in focus. Mm. We have a government right now that thinks about architecture as only a facade or just something that costs extra money, and instead of something that creates values. We wanted to show the importance of a strong political leadership. So we invited Mr. Peñalosa, who used architecture together with a very strong political leadership to make real change in the city.
Enrique Peñalosa is the former mayor of Bogotá, who transformed the Colombian city during his tenure as a mayor. He's most well known for building hundreds of kilometers of bike lanes across the capital. Peñalosa claims that architecture can create equality and happiness, a statement that drew big cheers from the gala audience. But he also pointed out that Stockholm suffers from segregation. Sweden's equal and tolerant image has recently been tarnished by events such as the riots in the Stockholm suburb of Husby this spring.
Equality has a lot to do with perception, with feeling excluded or inferior. I'm certain that many of these low-income immigrants here don't feel equal. They feel excluded. They feel inferior. It's important that people have the perception that they are connected, that the city is connected, that you don't have these isolated housing areas for low-income people. You can have a wonderful infrastructure for workers in a place like Husby, where you have train and you have good apartments, but maybe this is not very well connected by pedestrian infrastructure, for example, to higher income areas.
Stockholm is not the only Nordic city grappling with rapid urban growth. Architect Juho Grönholm from Finland shared his experiences from Helsinki, where his company ALA Architects is currently involved in several infrastructure projects. While there are no notable differences in architectural style between the two countries, Grönholm says, working as an architect is different in Finland.
I don't believe that the contemporary architect could say that he or she is following a style or representing a style. We are just doing contemporary architecture in Helsinki or in Norway or in Sweden or Copenhagen, or like some Danish architects are operating worldwide. The differences between my colleagues here in Stockholm and me or my colleagues in Helsinki are actually more about company sizes and the sort of structures. In Finland, we have a long tradition to have relatively small architecture studios, which are led by individuals. And in Stockholm, the architecture is mainly done by corporates, huge offices. Even Wienkord, who's probably the best-known Swedish individual architect, Wienkord's office is twice as big as the biggest office in Finland, or three times as big. That changes the climate, not necessarily style, but the results are different. In Finland, where the practices are relatively small, maybe some of the quality is not, or the diamonds are a bit rougher, one could say. In many cases, much more interesting. I wouldn't like to say that the quality isn't as good as corporate office would do, but there are differences in the results. I'm not one to judge which is better.
Stockholm's first architectural strategy, released some days after the gala, aims to increase the quality and variation in the city's building projects. It urges both politicians and Stockholmers to challenge their preconceived notions of the city and consider architecture that has not been seen before. But while Sweden could definitely benefit from an injection of creative architecture, there are also things other countries could learn from it, as Enrique Peñalosa pointed out.
Sweden has a great teaching to the world, which has not been used effectively, unfortunately. Since 1904, Sweden and Finland had most land around cities be bought by governments, local governments, so it's publicly owned land. The fact that land is private property is the cause for slums. And we have slums all over the world. Slums are in the wrong locations, many times in high-risk locations, flood areas or landslide areas without enough public spaces. Because clearly the market does not work in the case of land around growing cities, because when prices increase, the supply of land that is accessible to transport, to schools, to jobs, to water does not increase. So the market does not work in the case of land, because supply cannot increase, the supply of well-located land.
A successful architectural strategy for Stockholm will need to maintain the city's unique characteristics and add new ones that will make future generations proud, a task architects here are more than willing to take on. For Monocle in Stockholm, I'm Elna Nykänen-Andersson.
Coming up, we explore the Danube Island 25 years after it was created, and we visit the studio of British knitting brand Shepherd.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, from Midori House on Monocle 24. Vienna's location alongside the flood-prone Danube River had seen generations of engineers racking their brains as how best to protect the city from high water. Work that culminated in the late 1980s with the creation of the 20-kilometre-long Danube Island that split the river in half. Since then, the island has become one of the Austrian capital's best-loved leisure areas. But even today, as the island celebrates the 25th anniversary of its construction, there's still controversy over its status. Our correspondent in Vienna, Alexei Korolyov, has more.
The place is the Danube Island. The time, June this year. The Donauinsel Fest, Europe's biggest annual open-air festival, is in full swing. It's the festival's 30th anniversary, with visitor numbers reaching a record 3.2 million, nearly twice Vienna's entire population. But recreation was not exactly the Danube Island's original purpose. The island was the result of decades of engineering efforts to regulate the flow of the Danube River. Some of the earliest schemes to protect Vienna from flooding date back to the late 19th century.
Until the first half of the 19th century, the Danube River was just a wild river.
Harald Erber is one of the island's original creators.
So the Danube River parted in many branches. And it was necessary, and all these branches had to be transmitted by bridges. And high water destroyed, in many times destroyed bridges. So they built the so-called Durchstich, breakthrough. One straight riverbed instead of all these branches.
The central riverbed and a specially designed inundation area next to it were just about enough to keep the floods at bay well into the 1950s. But Vienna's rapid post-war growth called for new ideas. It was architect August Zottl, Harald Erber's senior partner, who came up with the most ingenious one.
The idea of Mr. Dr. August Zottl was to dig a second riverbed parallel to the main bed and deposit the digged material between the main riverbed and the new riverbed. So the second riverbed, the new Danube, called the new Danube, had to be closed and just opened for high water flow.
The island and the new Danube were completed in 1988, but already during their construction there had been much controversy about what to do with the island's vast grounds. Astonishingly, the city authorities withdrew their earlier construction tender and proclaimed "Alles für jedermann zur Verfügung." It's for everybody to have and enjoy.
At that time I took part in this competition and did not believe in the concept that this area, this island, would be kept free from buildings and compromises with representational uses and so on forever.
Architect Hermann Tschech had another vision.
I envisaged the possibility that this not privately owned strip of land should be taken up for solving the housing problem of the decade after.
His colleague Stefan Hübner even suggested a different shape for the new Danube.
Wir haben also damals vorgeschlagen, die Donauinsel nicht.
I proposed not to run the new raceway parallel to the Danube, Hübner says, but to bend it in the middle, so as to create an area which could be used for housing. But despite the Viennese authorities' commitment not to allow any construction on the island, Hübner says it's something that must happen.
Und es ist keine adäquate Nutzung in diesem Bereich. Es gibt dort
The area is not being used adequately, he says. We must build some decent architecture there instead of these sailing clubs and hot dog stands. Hermann Cech is, however, less critical.
I was wrong. The island is still free of building development, and it's accessible for everybody, and it's definitely a success. And I used to say, if in city planning, if a mistake is big enough, then later on it's called city development. And this has also been true here.
25 years on, the Danube Island still provokes debate. Vienna's Architekturzentrum, the architecture museum, held a panel discussion earlier this month to mark the island's anniversary.
So we've had these plans to make the Donauinsel a topic ever since the spring of this year, basically.
Caroline Meyer coordinated the event.
I think the curiosity comes because we generally think that a project like that would not be possible anymore today, because the economic interests would be so strong that land gained would definitely be building land, and the waterfront would be a fantastic site for luxury housing, basically.
Meyer says it's important that younger generations know just what a feat of engineering the island really was.
I think everybody my age and older knows that it's an artificial island, but I can imagine that younger people don't know that anymore. The danger is that the future generations will forget that it is actually a flood protection project. I think it is pretty unique.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Shepherd England's trademark scarves of neat geometric patterns are stocked by some of London's finest shops. Last time we checked, they were displayed on the most prominent table in Liberty's scarf room. Yet for all their luxurious design, their background is wholly down to earth. Emma Nelson pulled on her wellies and headed to the wet and woolly county of Kent to meet the designer Gemma Shepherd.
It's only 2 hours' drive from London into the English countryside, but it's as far from the smartness of the city as you could imagine. There's a big barn sheltering some rather impressive green double-decker buses. To the left is a large old farmhouse, to the right some sheep, and in front a dozen rather bossy white geese. It's cold, wet and windy. But in the corner of this farmyard is the workshop of arguably one of the hardest working women in design.
Okay, so this is my studio where I work. Come on in.
Studio is a loose description of the knitwear designer Gemma Shepherd's workplace.
It was a cattle shed. We used to have a couple of bulls living in here, but we've changed it round now. And although the roof's a little leaky, it's quite apt for the job.
What is it you'd like about your shed?
It's the space to work, I suppose. I was working from home, as lots of small businesses do, in the early days, but it's that need to grow.
Gently leaking roof aside, Gemma's workshop is warm and dry, with racks and racks of her trademark scarves, each with a striking geometric design. There are all the hallmarks of a busy company here, until you realise that everything is made on this. This one single knitting machine.
I work with the superfine Geelong merino yarn, which gives it's got a really lovely feel to it, and it wears beautifully. It also carries colour really nicely. Basically, my patterns are essentially quite geometric. We also have some more low-key tweeds, which that's a fabric that's always really interested me because of its kind of inherent Britishness, I suppose, and it sits really nicely alongside the more geometric patterns.
Gemma Shepherd didn't always work in a shed on her mother's farm. It was quite a while before she discovered that the future lay in a byproduct of some of the very animals she'd grown up around.
Did you ever think you would be a knitter?
God, no, I was useless. My granny was this incredible knitter, and she was an expert in knitting and crocheting, and she even had her own wool shop in the 60s, and she actually used to make dresses for Dusty Springfield and people like that in the swinging 60s. Don't know what it is that makes me love you so. I only know I I remember sitting with her, aged about 9, and she was just so kind of damning, really, about how rubbish I was. I mean, you know, that was Granny. I was working as a receptionist, and it was just so incredibly dull to me. And I used to knit, and I wasn't particularly good at hand knitting. It was ridiculous. And I actually showed my granny my effort, and she just said, "God, love, that's, you know, it's terrible." But anyway, so I thought, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I instead of me trying to do it, I'll buy myself a knitting machine. And I did, and I taught myself how to do it. So there's some determination there, because it's not that easy. I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to go and spend a couple of weeks with a guy called Sid Bryan. He's an amazing knitter, incredible. And I helped him out on the lead up to London Fashion Week. And he just inspired me, really. And so here I am.
How do ideas come to you sometimes?
You'll see something and you think, well, that's really beautiful. Can I translate that into knit?
Gemma picks out a few of her designs for me.
Yeah, I mean, Empire basically is quite a Art Deco kind of pattern. It's based on drawings and silhouettes of the New York skyline, and it worked as a repeat really beautifully.
Gemma describes her collection more as an archive. The emphasis here is on style rather than fashion. Each design vies to survive to the next season.
What was it like first trying to sell these ideas to big shops?
You think to yourself, right, let's just go for it. I mean, I think they're cool. Lots of people have said they're nice. Let's see what we can do with this. And in the beginning, I sent some out as gifts to buyers because it's very hard to get any recognition. That did work for me with one of my first big stockists. You know, you've got to break the ice some way, and that did work for me.
That first break took her by surprise. It was 8 months after she'd sent out her samples, and life had taken a different direction.
I had a 2-month-old baby, and I kind of decided that was it. I wasn't going to do anything for a year or so. And I got an email, and it was from a big store, and they said, "We really loved the scarf that you sent us, and we'd like to see your collection." And of course, I didn't have a collection, so I had to create one in about 4 weeks.
Over a bowl of homemade soup back in her kitchen, this family knows how to do cosy, Gemma's husband and emergency knitter, Joel, takes up the story.
The monumentality of the task was a little bit intimidating. I remember sort of going up there and actually learning how to use some of the knitting stuff and doing some of the knitting for her in, like, night shifts, listening to, I think there's an Ashes series down under, and I was, like, working quite late into the night, listening to cricket and knitting.
Tremendous shot.
The nature of the work's really mundane, but it was each kind of row knitted was maybe building towards something.
Gemma keeps tight control of her brand, from the thickness of the cardboard tags to the decision to use drawings on her website instead of real-life models. There's a singularity and a coherence to what she does, but she's now at the point where Shepherd England needs to be more than one woman and that knitting machine.
It would be lovely for me to have a team working around me, or perhaps even another company doing my branding for me. Someone that they can say, this is our idea, and then I can go, well, actually, I don't like it, because when you have to come up with all the ideas and you have to critique them yourself, it becomes sometimes kind of a strange, vicious circle, you know. You don't know whether you're getting it right.
Her last collection at Liberty sold 96% of its stock. Gemma says the next step for Shepherd England is to make homeware, items with a little more longevity than fashion. There's also the thought of a move back to London, to a shared space perhaps, although any co-worker would have to cope with that machine. Plus, one wonders if there's any better location for the solitary business of knitwear than Gemma Shepherd's shed. For Monocle, in Kent, I'm Emma Nelson.
Now, we have long been told about the importance of sleep. Few of us will disagree that a good night's rest helps us to perform whatever task the next day more productively. The hotel industry should surely be pioneers at providing easy and efficient sleep. It's their prime offering, after all. Last week, Monocle's David Pleasant went to Sleep 2013, the International Fair of Hotel Design, to meet Rob Morgan, the man behind Block Hotels, a new company that will soon be opening up more than 200 bedrooms, currently being built directly on top of London Gatwick Airport's South Terminal. He started by describing the concept behind the hotel.
The concept is relatively simple.
we have distilled luxury and technology into a relatively small space in order to make the rooms competitively priced. And we've combined numerous aspects of the room through the network. Each room has its own mini network. So the lighting, the blinds, the air conditioning, the television is all, and the door lock is connected via the network. So as a guest of Block Hotels, if you turn up to room 724 in Gatwick Airport in early 2014, you can have, via your smartphone, booked the hotel room, received the key on your smartphone to that hotel room. You use your smartphone to enter the room. Once you're in the room, then you have the ability to control the lighting, the air conditioning, the television, and the blackout blinds from your phone. So you really don't need to worry about how you switch things on, how you operate the remote control, how you cause the blinds to go up and down, and how you set the temperature to and the fan speed to the way you want it. It's all on your phone. So this is a classic great example of what's called the Internet of Things, and you know, the ability to interact with the Internet of Things using smart technology to access that. So we think we've come up with a really clever way of interacting with hotel rooms, and I think it's a spin on the hospitality industry that we're probably ahead of the rest of the market with. I think it's the way that they will go ultimately. Operationally, it's a great thing for the hotel not to have to worry about issuing keys or having people break remote controls or lose batteries to the remote controls, or really sort of not quite sure how to turn the lights on or off or what button to press to get the air conditioning on. It's all very intuitive, very straightforward.
At Monocle, some of our editors can be slightly technophobic, and I know we've sometimes complained about various consoles and various elements in hotel rooms, even the most kind of luxury of hotels. Yeah. What kind of have you done to kind of ensure that if I was just kind of to plonk myself on this bed after a long trip, that I would manage to get myself through that console?
Yeah, well, there's a great starter. When you open the door, there's a what's called a PIR sensor that picks up the fact that you've entered the room, and it will automatically turn the lights to a particular setting. It'll turn the air conditioning to a default 20 degrees temperature. If it's day, the blinds will be open. If it's night, the blinds will be shut. So there's automatically not a stumbling around, where do I put my card key and how do I turn these lights on? That's automatically done for you. So, you know, most of the thought process that goes into this is based on the fact that we love technology, but we're also relatively short in attention span, and we don't like to have to get the manual out how to work things. So it should be all very intuitive, very simple. Press a button that's very clearly says, you can see it here, lights, aircon, television, alarm, checkout. So there should be no doubt of what you have to do to achieve the sort of results you're looking for. Whereas you go to a lot of hotel rooms, and we've suffered from this ourselves, that it's like, oh my goodness, wonderful stuff here, but I don't even know how to turn it on. And I just want to look at the news, or I want to watch the football on Sky TV, which we've got plumbed into all of our higher end rooms. It's all ready to go.
How have you got to that kind of process? Has it been a long kind of journey? Have you had various kind of testing sessions, kind of user testing and so on? Tell us a bit about how you got here.
We're all users of the hospitality industry, and we've tested out other people's products for many decades. We have a research and development facility up in Birmingham. We have trawled the world for the smartest people, the best equipment to execute this plan of ours. And it hasn't been easy. It's not something you can Google and find immediately a solution to fit the bill that we've come up with. So I'm holding my Samsung NFC-enabled smartphone. I have booked a room at Block Hotels, paid for it with my credit card. I've received a message on this phone, which has then given an NFC code that's triggered off a device within the phone that then has turned the phone into a room key. So I'm holding my Samsung smartphone, and I will present it to the door. And that has opened the door.
It's actually worked. The door's opened, and we're into a different room. So it's as simple as that.
It's as simple as that.
At Monocle, we're always kind of interested in the kind of industry behind the industry, if you see what I mean, and what kind of expertise is there in this hotel and accommodation industry? Who is it that's kind of developing that software, and where are the hubs of it? Is it in Birmingham? Is it are you very much part of that, I imagine? Or I mean, who are the people that you're working with?
We are part of it. Like I said, you can't just Google it and find someone to come around and fit it for you, and there's not, you know, a shop you can go to give you the solution that we've come up with. It's not been a slow process, and we think we've got something that is kind of unique. You know, we're not sending people to the moon, but this is something that previously didn't exist. So I think we've established a leading edge, a cutting edge for technology in hotel rooms. And traditionally, the industry is slightly backward, to be honest with you. If you go and sit in your car and you realize, you know, you've got air conditioning at your fingertips, media at your fingertips, it's in a soundproofed, well-engineered piece of equipment that can actually go places and has an engine. And you think this is an incredible piece of development and engineering skill and technology. Then you go and sit in a hotel room and you go, actually, compared to a car, it's really sort of backward and nothing much has happened for many years. So I think the automotive industry is a good benchmark for us, and you sit in a relatively high-end car and you experience something that is truly kind of great engineering. And lots of it, you know, the UK is full of very smart people and full of very smart sort of engineers. And we pulled in some of the people that have been involved in that industry. So the Midlands is a place where, you know, Jaguar cars and Land Rover, Range Rover is flourishing right now. And some of our scientists that we've pulled in have been historically very involved in that industry. It's British design, it's British engineering, but we've used the finest materials from around Europe and the world, really.
That was Rob Morgan of Block Hotel speaking to David Pleasant at Sleep 2013 in Islington, London. Coming up, we cast our eye over architectural developments in Asia with founder of Design Practice, Office for Architectural Culture, Charles Fu.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, in our attempts to offer up a global selection of stories, it's perhaps inevitable that some will fall by the wayside. That's why, from now on, we'll take a moment to look over some of the big developments across design and architecture in a country or region. Each week, we'll have a special guest as our guide, a journalist, expert or practitioner, or sometimes all three. Design director and founder of Practice Office for Architectural Culture, Charles Fu, kickstarts this new feature, talking me through some of the most recent developments across Taiwan and Asia at large. A region where old meets new, and naturally, East meets West is the name of the architectural game.
Interestingly, because I've been detached from what's happening in Taiwan in terms of architectural industry, but the last year or two, I've seen quite a lot of new developments, especially developments with involvement of foreign architects. So the whole architectural design industry has opened up to the international community.
What sort of people foreign people are working there?
Well, actually, projects ranging from commercial, residential to, you know, national cultural projects, such as performing arts projects, national library, museums, and more projects are handled with international design competitions.
And what are the sort of challenges when you do get a whole load of foreign talent coming to one country? How do you try and create one unified sort of national taste if you've got all these sort of things colliding into one nation?
Well, I think that's interesting, but also a universal challenge. So when the local, what's so-called local industry and creativity and traditions in that and meet the foreign international minds, I think it's always interesting and challenging as well. Because I think both the local architects and international architects need to learn project by project. Every project is different, especially when people come, well, let's say like international architects come to Taiwan to undertake a project. They probably thought, oh, Taiwan is another, it's a Chinese community. And they thought, they expected that it's, things probably were similar the way, you know, the similar way to China, but actually it's quite different because, you know, the especially the last 50-60 years, the society development here in Taiwan is, you know, completely different from the mainland China, and let alone the politics and the culture.
And how does that play out in design and architecture? I mean, what sets Taiwan apart from China, particularly in the way the sort of, you know, the cities or residential architecture appear?
Well, Taiwan, it has been developing since, well, actually after the war, a few decades earlier than China. So in terms of architectural industry, construction industry, I would say it's more advanced than China, especially with influences from Japan and United States over the last 40, 50 decades. It's already quite mature in Taiwan. Interestingly, because of that, the minds of Taiwanese local architects are not as open as those in China, because they thought, you know, they probably thought they, you know, they have, you know, traditions and they're well established. So at the beginning, especially maybe 10, 20 years ago, they weren't as open to the international design community as mainland China is now. It took a longer time to get to the point now, but now I think it's quite interesting and exciting.
What are some of the best examples of this sort of East meets West style?
There are actually quite a few. Let me take an example which actually my practice is involved now. We just won a project which is a presidential memorial library and museum in Taiwan dedicated to the former president Chin Kuo Chang or Nicolai Chang, who established the first real democracy in the whole Chinese community globally. And because his legacy, well, actually he was educated in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 1930s, where he took a lot of new advanced ideas from the West, as well as the so-called socialist world. And he somehow managed to transform those ideas into a so-called a modern version of democracy, if you like, or social transformation, integrated with the Chinese traditional philosophy or thought. The challenges for this project are about how to integrate his traditional philosophy and his advanced visions. And so architecturally, how to integrate these things into the design without formally strongly visual means. That's the challenge. Our design scheme was liked and appreciated by the client, which showed the openness of the Taiwanese society to the different thoughts and different ideas and different cultural backgrounds, if you like, as well as political backgrounds.
And just in terms of the actual, more of the principles of the architecture, how have you tried to bring across this conversation between all that in the actual design of the building?
Well, in terms of the actual design of the building or of the environment, I try to integrate, which actually quite successfully done, is integration of traditional Chinese philosophy traditional architectural principles and like the Chinese landscape architecture, as well as, I would say, Western democracy, you know, the ideas of Western democracy, the original philosophy of socialism, which is not the socialism or communism we know about today, but, you know, the original, which is supposed to be quite idealistic. You know, all these things, plus how each individual can express their thinking, their thoughts, their opinions. So by integrating all this into the actual architectural and environmental design without visually expressing it, so how people or users experience the building or the space is not by the formality, I would say formality or style, but it's sort of the influence by means of subconsciousness. People naturally get influence and get the message or messages that the building or the project is trying to send.
Also, one last question. I mean, what's the standard of homegrown architecture like in Taiwan at the moment? You mentioned a lot of international architects going over there to work, but yeah, what's the local style like?
I would say local in terms of style is quite hard to define because, you know, Taiwan is quite a hybrid society. So it's got the Chinese traditions, but also it's got a lot of influences from the States and Japan. But I would say now, I think the most interesting, I would say, movement in Taiwan is green architecture, sustainable architecture. So on one hand, the regulations or requirements by the government for green architecture are quite strict. I would say equally high as what we have in the UK or Europe. That's always on top of the agenda for design projects.
Charles, thank you very much for talking with me. Charles Fu of Office for Architectural Culture there. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, of Monocle 24. Other than temples and churches, can religion influence the design and shape of a building? In his latest book, Kabbalah in Art and Architecture, Alexander Gorlin explores the spiritual undertones of some of the world's most iconic constructions, including Louis Kahn's 1965 Salk Institute for Biological Studies in California and the Villa Malaparte in Capri. Our very own Santiago Tarditi interviewed Gorlin in New York City and discussed the story behind his book, analysing the parallels between ancient texts and modern edifices.
It started from a commission to design a synagogue in Kings Point, Long Island, and I had no experience with the design of synagogues. And I knew I did not want to do a historical one, nor a theme from the 1960s, such as a burning bush motif. So I opened up the books of Gershom Scholem, who's a great academic scholar of the Kabbalah, and to my great surprise found a number of concepts that are intimately related to architecture and art, that deal with light and space and geometry, and themes that are contemporary and inspired my designs. But then led out into other worlds, such as the world of art from the 1950s, contemporary art, in a series of 10 different themes that the book outlines.
What are these themes? Could you go through some of them?
The themes are based on the creation of the universe, according to Rabbi Isaac Luria from the 16th century, in which the creation starts rather than with an active gesture of the divine, that is, let there be light, it's a contraction. So the idea of like pulling away, creating a vacuum or the void is the initial theme of the book. And that is also the idea of the void in art and architecture is a very strong theme that is established in architecture today. The second theme is the vessels of light, where the light after the initial contraction of the universe is in 10 different vessels or bottles of light. And these bottles of light that float in the void is one of the basic ideas of architecture, the idea of architecture as a container or a vessel of light. And that, and one can see that clearly in the work of Stephen Hull or Frank Gehry or the Maison de Verre. It's something that has been in architecture, but clearly it's a Kabbalistic theme as well. Then the third concept is the sephirot, which is the emanations of the divine light and how they manifest themselves in the world. And this idea of emanations, which is similar to the Kundalini yoga, which has chakra points or points of the body and they are corresponding to the body, also creates this geometric diagram, an interlocking network of forces. So the idea of this, an interlocking relationship of forces of the universe, is something that is essential to architecture as well as life. Then at a certain point, these vessels of light cannot contain the divine light, and so they shatter. So the idea of the breaking of the vessels, this cosmic catastrophe, is equivalent to perhaps deconstruction or the idea of the world in a series of disparate elements that are kind of floating separately, but the result of this catastrophe of the breaking of the initial form of the universe. Then the theme of tikkun or tikkun olam is the idea of repairing the universe. And so it's our obligation to take the 288 sparks that were left after the breaking of the vessels and to bring them back to the divine. And so the idea of repair, sustainability, the obligation of helping people and is something that is also equivalent in architecture. Even just something as basic as restoration.
What are some of the buildings that you found have a direct link to this Kabbalah history? And is there any building in New York in particular?
One of the issues of the book was whether to limit it to those buildings that are intentionally Kabbalistic, such as Daniel Libeskind's Berlin Museum, or illustrative of these concepts. And after speaking to one of the great scholars, Moshe Idel, who encouraged me to include those that are non-intentional, that opened up the possibility of the book. And so there are buildings such as, for example, Stephen Hall's Nelson Atkins Museum, which he conceived of as a series of vessels of light that float on this pool of reflecting water. Surprisingly, I found was Herzog and de Meuron's Bird's Nest, which was equivalent to a phrase from the mystical book of the Kabbalah, the Zohar, where it said that the Messiah dwells in the bird's nest. So there are a series of buildings that illustrate these ideas.
Are these concepts influencing your architecture nowadays?
Now that the book is out, it's re-influencing my work. So that making it a public statement allows me to use these concepts more objectively.
Has the Kabbalah influenced other areas of design beyond architecture?
The book deals with the realm of art as well. And so there are many artists who use these themes, such as Amy Siegel in her work about the void and suburbia, or Cornelia Parker, whose work is about breaking and shattering, and is very similar to an exhibit at the Hirshhorn called Explosions.
Are there any other religions that are having a strong influence in architecture? And do you have any interest in exploring these other religions, or are you mainly focused on the Kabbalah?
No, I'm very ecumenical, and I've always been interested in all religions, for example, Hinduism and its relationship to the idea of cycles of life and rebirth. And Islamic mysticism is also of interest, as well as medieval Christian mysticism, which deals a great deal with light and its kind of elementary ideas.
What is going to be your next big project, and how is this ecumenical belief going to influence it?
My next project is renovating and readapting the Bell Laboratories by Eero Saarinen in New Jersey, which I just got, and it's 2 million square feet. It has a 1,000-foot atrium. It's on 400 acres, and it's been empty for 7 years. It was finished in 1962 by the great architect Saarinen, who did the TWA terminal. It was originally a laboratory for Bell Telephone, and the laser, the cell phone was invented there, and now we're readapting it to a 24-hour facility of offices, retail. But I'm very interested in developing a arts and music program for the space. So that's my project at the moment. And it in a sense, becoming potentially spiritual space. It has certain Kabbalistic overtones to it. Oh, and then another project that I'm working on is with Pharrell Williams, who's very interested in affordable prefabricated housing. And I was interviewed by him for his TV show in January. And then we've met a number of times since then. And we're developing a very high design but affordable prefab house that one could buy in Walmart, for example. So meeting with Pharrell is quite fantastic because he's creative and he's cross-disciplinary. And in a sense, that's similar to the idea of mysticism as being cross-religious, cross-disciplinary, and bringing themes that are common to humanity and making architecture out of them.
That was Alexander Gorlin speaking to Monocle's Santiago Tarditi. And that brings us to the end of Section D for this week. Today's show is produced by Aled John and David Pleasant and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out of show number 111, this is One by Amy Mann. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.